Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, June 28th. The fourth arrest of a state sheriff this week has people asking, what is going on with the new Department of Law Enforcement? We hear from its director this morning. Hawaiian Electric Company plans to file a preliminary report today with state regulators about what it thinks may have caused the outages in downtown Honolulu. And we learn more about the claims process and concerns of small businesses in Chinatown. We hear from those directly affected, as well as the state consumer advocate. On Maui, the push to convert short-term vacation rentals to long-term housing is getting underway. And we take a closer look at possible hitchhikers on canoe plants from the days of early navigators. The conversation starts right after national and local headlines. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Department of Law Enforcement addresses the arrests of four of its state sheriffs in two separate probes in less than 2 weeks. But there could be additional arrests as the third probe is underway. We get clarification from the director, Jordan Lowe. The department was created in January this year, consolidating responsibilities from the old Public Safety Department. Director Lowe talked to us earlier this morning.
On January 1st, of 2024, all of the law enforcement assets from the various state agencies transferred over into the Department of Law Enforcement. And then after that, sometime in May, it was brought to our attention that there were misconduct relating to some of the sheriffs in the Capitol Central Patrol and at the airport. So obviously, you know, we started to investigate that because, you know, we have zero tolerance in that type of behavior. And the other thing is, you know, as a new department, we're striving to have professionalism and accountability to the public. So as we were conducting those investigations, that's how it came about. There's actually three investigations. I think people were confused thinking that it was all one related investigation. No, it's actually three separate investigations. You know, one relates to, again, Capitol Central Patrol. One relates to conduct at the airport. And then there's a totally separate third investigation that, again, relates to some of the deputies over at Central Patrol. But, you know, the real message, you know, that I want the public to hear is that these are isolated incidents. You know, we have over 200 deputies, you know, currently working, and, you know, they are professional, dedicated law enforcement officers trying to protect and serve the public. So as in any organization, you are going to have these instances where they need to be addressed. You know, I would like the public, for them to have full confidence, you know, in the Department of Law Enforcement and the Sheriff's Division, that, you know, we are out there every day working to provide a service for them.
Well, I just wonder, how far did these complaints go back, one, and did the complainants, you know, go to the union about their concerns?
My understanding was the two incidents, the one relating to Central Patrol and the airport, those are recent incidents because just the timing of it. We learned that they, you know, it probably had occurred, you know, for at least a month, if not more. So, I mean, without actually going into the details of the investigation, because it is ongoing, whether the individuals, you know, went to the union, I'm not aware of that.
Okay. And then what about the third investigation?
The third investigation we learned about through another incident that happened. And while we were looking into that incident, was how we uncovered potential misconduct on the parts of the other deputies.
Okay. And so are all these deputies then on paid leave?
Yes, they are on administrative leave with pay, and their police authority has been restricted.
There were the four recent arrests, but is it correct that there are nine sheriffs that are on leave?
My understanding is there was two arrests on the first investigation relating to the Capital District. And then there were two arrests recently relating to the incidents at the airport. So those people have been placed on administrative leave with pay. The third investigation, five deputies have been placed on administrative leave with pay.
Wow. Okay, so, and what happens to the complainants and their safety because, there's concern about retaliation?
Sure, and once we learned of the incidents, we transferred them away from the section because, we don't want retaliation, and we're concerned about their wellness and well-being. So they were transferred to different parts of the department.
Yeah, and one of these probes concerns discrimination. What is the department doing to address that?
So again, we are fully investigating the incident. But what we've also done is we have put out a directive last week to require that all employees of the department law enforcement, to include civilian employees, to undergo the Department of Human Resources training on workplace violence and harassment.
To your knowledge, were there other incidents, were allegations of discrimination? We were hearing that it involved a black officer.
So that investigation is ongoing right now.
Can't say anything
Correct.
More on that?
Right, because it is a criminal investigation.
So what are the steps at this point? These sheriffs have been arrested, all released pending the investigation?
Correct.
And how are we doing, covering their responsibilities? I don't know how you're sitting for vacancies, if you've got shortages within your department.
We have a substantial amount of vacancies right now, unfortunately. It's very hard to recruit applicants, to join the department. And that's actually been a problem for a while. So when, we have a number of people placed on administrative leave with pay, we still have to fulfill our mandates and obligations. And usually that would require reorganizing some of the units, incurring overtime costs.
Okay, but you're able to cover at this point?
The best we can, yes.
What kind of vacancy rate do you have? I ask because, we had just had Tommy Johnson on from Corrections, and, they're in the middle of a campaign to hire more adult correction officers for the prisons.
Sure.
And he says, I think they're like a quarter short of where they should be as far as staffing. And that's why there's this big push to get the training stepped up and get more recruits in the door. Mm-hmm. But where does a law enforcement department stand?
It's at least a quarter short, if not more.
And are we looking at a campaign to boost those numbers possibly?
So we're hoping to recruit again in July, next month, or at the end of July or beginning of August. So we will be active in trying to put a recruitment campaign out. We did one earlier this year, actually might have been the beginning of, toward the end of last year, and we have a recruit class going on right now with, I think it's 11 recruits right now that's going through the academy.
I believe it's your department that was investigating the shipment of fireworks into the prison system. Correct me if I'm wrong. Can you give us
that is the Attorney General's Investigation Division that's working that case.
Okay, not your department. Okay, I thought Tommy said that it was you folks, but okay. So I guess I'll check with the AG on that one. It's 4th of July next week, and I just had asked when I talked to corrections about where that was at. Oh, gosh. Anything else you want to say? Are there more arrests to come?
I think that would depend on the progression of the investigation. It's possible.
Okay, but two for the first at the Capitol, two arrests for the airport, and five for the third probe?
Nobody has been arrested on a third probe. There's five deputies that have been placed on administrative leave with pay.
That was Jordan Lowe, director of the Hawaii Department of Law Enforcement, talking with us about the arrests of four state sheriffs in two separate probes, five others on leave, pending a third probe. No arrests have been made in that investigation.
This week's performance at HPR's Hawaii Jazz Performance Series is sold out. Mahalo for your support. Watch videos from past HPR concerts and sign up for email alerts for future performances. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org, sponsored by Farm Lovers Markets.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Claudia Lamoureux, founder of Mindful Digital Life and parenting coach. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how to live well with technology.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
One electric company is expected to file a preliminary report with the Public Utilities Commission at some point today. It's to provide info on a suspected cause of the recent power outage in downtown Honolulu. We talked to Jim Kelly, HECO Vice President for Government and Community Relations and Corporate Communications.
Right now it looks like it was a cable fault. You can think of that like a short circuit in one of the high voltage cables running under the street. What we have to do beyond that, we're going to be doing what we call a root cause analysis. So we have to find out, okay, well, why did that cable fault? Is there some piece of equipment that didn't work correctly? What, you know, there's a lot of different pieces of equipment under the street, splices and cable insulation and other equipment that we're going to have to look at to try to get at, okay, well, why did that cable fault happen? And making sure that we have an understanding of that and make sure it doesn't happen again.
There, you know, is concern just because it, you know, it happened several times and, you know, it's not an easy fix. So what can you tell us about the timetable for upgrading, you know, your cables in that critical area?
Sure. We've had a program going back to the 2010s where we've been upgrading all of the equipment under the street. And in Chinatown, downtown, the underground utilities all go back to the 1950s. So there's a lot of equipment that was installed 50s, 60s, 70s. And so over time, we've been replacing that, upgrading that. And over the last, you know, since the 2010s, we've probably got about 25% of that replaced. We're right now looking at how we could accelerate that replacement program so we get all of it done, hopefully within the next 10 years. But we're also looking at, there's some areas and the part on King Street there toward Chinatown where we had the fire. There's a lot of stuff in those manholes. And if we were going to design it today, that's not how we would do it. And so we're looking at, there may be some areas where we have to do more extensive, you know, digging up the street and doing kind of more extensive work than simply just replacing the cables under the street.
And from what I understand, you folks were doing these upgrades and then COVID hit. And, you know, obviously it made it more complicated just because being in, you know, small spaces, confined spaces, was not a good thing during the pandemic. Conditions aren't the best down there, right?
No, they're not. And as I said, if we were going to design it today, we would not do it the way that it's laid out right now. In addition to the work that happens under the street, we are also right now, over the next 2 months, and it should be by August 1st, we have a transformer that serves the downtown area and provides some redundancy on downtown circuits. We're in the process of replacing the transformer at one of our substations right now. And when that gets done, say by August 1st, that's going to again provide us some more redundancy downtown and in Chinatown so that if there is a problem on one particular circuit, we can usually switch over to another circuit and have whatever interruption might be a lot shorter.
And can you give us some sense? I mean, I know that's our financial district, you know, but there sure are a lot of fiber optics laid down in that area. And I don't know, it probably looks like spaghetti down there. I don't know how it's organized, but like you said, you're dealing with, you know, old systems.
Yes, the area on King Street there, the manhole near Nutuano and also near Bethel. I haven't personally been down there, but my understanding, it's about a 6-foot by 6-foot by 4-foot wide space down there. So it's very, very tight. a lot of that is just taken up by our equipment, and there's heavy-duty cables, conduits that run then to each the customers. You know, like when you see overhead lines and you're driving down the street and you'll see what we call a service drop, you'll see a line going to somebody's house along the street there. I mean, it's essentially the same thing underground. There's a line that goes to each customer, and some of the larger customers, people that have a lot of equipment and it's kind of a heavier load, and there's, you know, can be a heavier cable that goes to their place of business. And so just keeping all of that straight under the street is, yes, it's very complex. It is one of the reasons that it took so long to get the power back on, was that there was this really intense flash of energy under there, and a lot of those cables got fused together and melted, and it was kind of challenging to pull that out of there and also figure out where it went when they put it back together.
And as far as the working conditions, I mean, I understand that there are crews that sometimes get sent down there and there are still some live lines that they're working next to?
Yeah, I mean, that's why the challenge of doing the work downtown, especially, as you said, it's our financial district, and our underground crews are specially trained. They're trying to get this work done while not turning off the power. And that's why it takes longer sometimes. So they're down there with all of the lines energized and doing this work so that we're not having to do what we call planned outages and, you know, telling residents and businesses, hey, we're going to be turning the power off for a few hours so we can get this work done. So, but it's very, you know, it's very tricky. It's very complex. It has to be done very precisely. And the people that work underground, these are specially trained people that just do this kind of work. It isn't like you can take someone who's used to working above ground, doing a different kind of a job. There's special training, and a lot of it has to do with safety that these crews go through, and they have a very unique skill set.
Do we have to bring in other workers from the outside, or you have just your core group that can handle that?
No, we have our core group, and they probably know every square inch of our underground system, probably see it all in their sleep because they've worked it so much. You know, another one of the challenges they have is because downtown is a lot of it, you know, it's built on fill, and when we have high tide events, they can go down in the manhole and they'll see that it's halfway filled up with water, or sometimes filled up all the way with water.
Wow.
So some of the time they have to spend is pumping it out, especially if we have a big rain event too.
Wow, before they can even work on there.
Yes.
Very challenging. Well, I understand that you will be reaching out to the businesses down there in the Chinatown area this weekend.
Yes, we have been in contact with a lot of folks in Chinatown. We're hoping over the weekend that we're going to be able to meet with some businesses and business owners and help some of them navigate the claims process, fill out forms, answer questions about what happened and what we're working on, and generally just be able to try to offer some support. We want to look at other opportunities where we can provide support to the businesses down there. Also just, you know, getting ready for future events, helping them get information about what they can do to, you know, make sure they have all the information that they need for, you know, hopefully we will not have any future outages like this, but always good for everyone to be prepared. And we want to be able to share information about that as well.
Is there anything you can say about the claims from last year? Because I believe it was, 9 out of 10 weren't paid?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a relatively few. I mean, there's less than 1,000 claims were filed, and we have over 400,000 customers. So it's a relatively small number that are filed. You know, the tariff established by the PUC is, and it's on the website, essentially, we get a lot of claims after storms, for example, but to receive compensation, you basically have to show that the utility didn't do something that was under its control, that the utility could have done something and didn't. And so something like a storm, something like, you know, someone hitting a pole and the pole falls over and the power goes out, that's not something that's within the company's control. So that's why we start all claims discussions with, okay, let's find out what happened. What was the cause of this outage? And so that's the process we're in right now. And so determination has to be made. Okay, well, was this something that the company was within their control to fix, or is it something that was not within the company's control? So that's what we need to figure out before we go ahead with the claims process.
That was Jim Kelly, Vice President for Hawaiian Electric Company, talking with us about the recent power outages in the downtown Honolulu Financial District, nerve central for big businesses, as well as in Chinatown, the area that impacts many small businesses. We will have more on this right after a break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, Bavarian Motor Experts, and Chaminade University.
HPR has won a first-place Spot News Award from the Public Media Journalists Association.
Hurricane Dora missed the islands by hundreds of miles, but experts say that's still close enough for the storm system to pose serious risks of wildfires.
Listen to HPR's award-winning stories at hawaiipublicradio.org/awards.
Hawaiian Electric will be on hand this Sunday at an event at the United Chinese Society office on 42 North King Street from 3 o'clock to 6 p.m. this weekend. The event was organized by the Chinatown Business Association to help small businesses with questions about filing claim forms. We spoke to Leslie Niebuhr, the marketing director and co-owner of Black Shamrock Tavern. The business was forced to close for days and lost a week's worth of perishable food.
Yeah, we lost all of our perishable food, which is, we had, you know, several batches of dough made. You have to make, for pizza dough, you have to make it in advance, like a couple of days before you're going to actually use it. So we had, gosh, I don't know, lots of pizza dough that had to be thrown out, that we had made, you know, cheese, tomato sauce, meat, all that stuff is done. We had to take it. We took it to the dump yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of businesses nowadays, as everyone knows, since COVID and even before, the restaurant business is a tough business as it is, especially now. It's hard to find staff. It's hard to just run a business, period. So when you lose a day, it's difficult. When you lose 4 days, some businesses, especially restaurants, are barely hanging on as it is. And so to lose that many days of income, not only for us, but our employees, you know, they're not getting paid. And then also to lose the actual product, it's just not helpful. We can file a claim with HECO, but we don't, they've been vague about what exactly you can claim. They're sort of like, well, whatever you think. And it's like, well, but what's going to be approved? And then, okay, you file the claim, and then when will it be addressed? In a year? That doesn't help me next week when I have payroll.
That was Leslie Niebuhr of the Black Shamrock Tavern. She sent us an update today that her business hasn't yet filed a claim with HECO, but she plans to. She is going to attend Sunday's meeting and hopes that it will provide more answers about the damage claims process. You know, we also caught up with Mike Angelo, the consumer advocate at the Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs, to talk about the recent downtown outage. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Angelo about the claims process and why 90% of the damage claims filed with HECO back in 2023 were denied.
The company is the one who winds up being the ultimate determiner of whether or not a claim gets paid out. It would be better to have an advocate representing some of these cases. One of the things that we do is help customers. We can help them walk through filing a complaint with the commission. but it would help if we hear from the general public as to what their particular concerns are, what they've been experiencing with the reasons that their claims are being denied, for example, and we can go and look into that with the utility.
Of those hundreds of claims, there are still hundreds of thousands of customers. So the fact that less than 1,000 claims are filed represents quite a small percentage. I guess, what are the reasons behind that? Why do maybe so few people file claims?
There's a couple of things. One, they could be happy with their quality of service, right? They had a momentary outage. There wasn't any loss that they felt that they should be able to compensate for. Or it could be people are just not aware that they're able to do this. And one of the things that our office wants to do is increase awareness that consumers have this ability to go out and file for claims if they feel that there was a loss because of the outage that they had.
Yeah, and bringing things up to speed with the recent power outage in the downtown Chinatown area, I think a lot of people were left with some confusion over what actually constitutes a claim in that process. So what can you share to demystify that?
Customers have the ability to file a claim directly with Hawaiian Electric within 30 days of the service interruption. Again, Hawaiian Electric is the one who determines whether or not they're responsible or liable for the interruption. If customers are not satisfied with that, they can go through the process of filing a complaint with the Public Utilities Commission, and we have on our website, we have links to the different informal and formal processes for filing complaints with the Public Utilities Commission in terms of what can be claimed. Our reading of the rule is that any reasonable loss, any loss can be claimed. So if you have something like perishable food, you could claim that, or even things like revenue losses, damaged equipment should all be covered.
That's helpful to know, because I took a look at the claim form and they have...
It looks like
it should just be electric appliances.
Equipment, yeah, electric appliances, yeah.
Okay.
The way we're looking at it, and our attorneys have looked at it and have advised that we see this as broader than that.
Okay, but ultimately it is... With that form, HECO's discretion of whether or not they determine a claim to be viable.
That's correct.
But we still don't know what caused the initial power outage. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the utility has indicated that they'll be filing a report on what their determination is on what the causes of that outage were. What action we would take to advise customers to do ahead of that. I think they can file that. They believe there was a violation of Rule 16 and then go from there so that at least it's on the record.
Is aging infrastructure a way that the company could have done something better?
I think grids across the nation, including Hawaiian Electric, are faced with aging infrastructure is a problem. And we're going to have to take a long look, a broad look in terms of what we need to prioritize and where those dollars need to go to either replace or upgrade things to make sure that safe and reliable service is maintained. In this case, obviously, my understanding is that some of those cables were rather old, but we're going to need to take a close look at if Hawaiian Electric could have done anything differently or should have done anything differently.
And with the fixes and upgrades that might come down the line, it could take up to 10 years. What should all these businesses and consumers in the downtown and Chinatown areas know about what that will mean for their service?
Nobody wants to have intermittent outages. It's a key to having a strong business culture in Hawaii. It's paramount to customers who have life support equipment. In terms of what folks can do, there are programs out there like HGIA has for low-income customers can go out and help with the upfront cost of installing things like solar. Folks can invest in things like batteries or backup generation, but you know there's all costs associated with those things. So there's not a perfect solution, but backup power might be one of them. And from our end, we're going to be focusing on making sure that there's investments to replace infrastructure where necessary, and an ounce of cure is worth a pound of prevention.
Yeah, I mean, we spoke to some of the local businesses that had their power go out for the better part of a week, and a lot of restaurants are in that area, mm-hmm. and the margins are already razor thin for them. So these small local businesses saying that now that the power is back on, they really took a hit in terms of perishable food items and just having to do payroll and pay rent when they don't have any customers or the ability to charge customers with their credit card machines.
Right. To your point, I was just having a discussion with this with someone this morning. Those margins are razor thin, and losing revenues for 3 days could wipe out an entire profit margin for the month and dip into, now you're in the red, right? And what do we do about that going forward? We really need to focus on making sure that we have safe, reliable electricity service for all consumers.
What is your office doing in the short term to make the process a little bit clearer to help some of these businesses and consumers, and if they need to file claims, how to go about doing that?
So we have information on our website, which folks can go to at cca.hawaii.gov/DCA/file-a-complaint. That'll point folks to information. There's information on our Facebook page. They can also call us directly at 808-586-2800, and we can help walk them through the process on how to file a complaint under Hawaiian Electric's rule number 16, or if they are not getting satisfactory results through filing a complaint with the commission.
And anything else you want to add?
Safe and reliable service is really important, particularly safety. So if you see any issues on your utility poles, like climbing vines heading up or trees in the area of power lines, be sure to contact Hawaiian Electric to make them aware of that, and let us know if you're not getting satisfactory results. And we should be having some information come out in the next few weeks on what folks can do to contact the electric utilities directly so that these things can be resolved.
That was Mike Angelo, the state's consumer advocate, talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have a link to the website that he mentioned on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Support for HPR comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company serving the island since 2005, committed to providing personal service to each customer, featuring a locally based customer care team. Learn more at mobi.com.
Why are vampires kind of everywhere in our culture? And what fears do they symbolize? When Dracula first got published, the English were preoccupied with nationalism, their borders, and the disruption of the pure national body. But over the decades, vampires have also been used to stoke fears of queerness and Black power. That's next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Maui County this week took the first step in converting short-term vacation rentals into long-term housing. HPR's Maui Niue reporter Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel has been tracking this issue and joins us with more on the story. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, you were covering the marathon meeting this week.
Yes, the Maui Planning Commission heard hundreds of testifiers at a very long meeting on Tuesday. There was a huge line to enter the county chambers in Wailuku, and the meeting began at 9 a.m., and there were about 250 testifiers signed up. They only made it through about 150 of them, and they will reconvene on July 9th to continue the discussion. Maui has the highest number of actively listed short-term rentals in the state at about 14,000, and half of those would be phased out under the mayor's proposal. It would affect about 7,000 short-term rental units in apartment-zoned districts. So these units were built before 1989. They're also known as the Minatoya List. And this proposal's goal is to create more long-term housing for residents. It's unclear at this point how many units would actually be converted into long-term rentals or how many would be, you know, retained by owners. But it's under discussion, and this will be a long process. So Mayor Richard Bisson shared remarks and statistics before the public testimony began.
This morning, UHERO released an analysis that shows that this proposal would increase Maui's long-term residential housing stock by 13%. Since the 1980s to the early 2000s, we've averaged approximately a 2% increase in housing units every year. But more concerning, is from 2018 to 2022, we're actually losing units. We know that regulatory and infrastructure limitations paired with skyrocketing costs have made it extremely difficult to build homes in Maui County. While we remain focused on ways to better support affordable housing projects, we cannot build ourselves out of this problem. We need a continuum of housing for all types of families, and increased housing capacity will bring more balance to the housing market. In West Maui, only 34% of all housing units are for residents, with 66% of those units classified as non-resident second homes or TBRs.
You know, and I've heard some discussion about, you know, how much revenue that Maui could lose, you know, if it does go through with this conversion. But yeah, it's lots of, you know, serious issues to consider here.
Yeah, so the UH's economic research organization is conducting an impact study on the economics, exactly what those numbers would look like if this goes through. They won't be completed with that study by the time this goes through the Maui Planning Commission process, but it will help guide the county's ultimate decision on whether or not to move forward with this. So we will have more numbers and a better look at what the economics will look like moving forward. They heard testimony, you know, of course, for and against the proposed ordinance from short-term rental owners, from realtors, members of the hospitality industry who opposed it, and also fire survivors, students, you know, just all types of Maui residents who support it. Rent in Maui County is the most expensive in Hawaii, and Hawaii is known as the most expensive rent in the county, and so the median rent on Maui has gone up by 40% this year over last year. And so folks are just having a really hard time getting housing, as we've been hearing, of course, exacerbated by the August fire. In West Maui, nearly 50% of housing is short-term rentals, as we heard Mayor Bisson say. And so it's a really big issue that's being weighed. Lahaina resident Krishna Bayudan supported the ordinance and talked about how the fire and the skyrocketing housing costs are affecting her.
Last night, I checked Zillow. After our insurance money is gone, my family will have to pay $15,000 to $20,000 a month for a four-bedroom home in Lahaina. How can we afford these sky-high rents when our homes are not even rebuilt? I'd like to refute the argument of job loss and a downturn in our economy. My dad and many others that lost their businesses in the fire have naturally inclined to adapt and move forward. My dad filed for UI and found another job. How can we envision a future when the most basic needs are not met? I graduated college and returned home to prepare for medical school. Because of the housing instability I experienced, I was more worried about the roof over my head rather than moving forward with my personal goals. This phase out will restore balance to our housing market.
Yeah, you just feel for them. Boy, that's a big nut to crack.
Absolutely. And, you know, of course, there's a lot to weigh on the other side of it as well. Andrew Church is a Maui resident whose family income is directly tied to the short-term rental industry.
As a short-term rental owner with condos at Kihei Bay Vista and Kihei Bay Surf, I'm here to express my strong opposition to the proposed legislation to ban short-term rentals on Maui. My wife, my daughter, and I survive entirely on the management and the rental income from our short-term rentals. All our properties are on the Minutoya list. Therefore, this ban would essentially wipe out our entire household income. Our family members work as property owners, as well as they run activity businesses, they work in snorkel boats, they work in luaus, they work at hospitality service, they work as cleaners, electricians, and so on. The passage of the county's proposed legislation to ban short-term rentals will be financially catastrophic and a final blow for my family. This proposed ban will bankrupt my family. Since May 3rd, when the mayor gave his press conference, we have not had a chance to sleep.
Yeah, that's tough.
A lot of testimony on both sides was heard by the Maui Planning Commission. I definitely don't envy their decision-making process in this moving forward. And it will go through not only the Maui Planning Commissions, but also the Molokai and Lanai Planning Commissions as part of the process. There are rental units on this list on Molokai as well. And so it does affect countywide. The Maui Planning Commission meeting lasted for 11 hours. And as I said earlier, about 100 testifiers were remaining in the queue when the meeting ended at about 8 p.m. And so they will be reconvening, and commissioners will make a recommendation to the county council. So the council is the deciding body on this, and all of the planning commissions will hear testimony from their islands and ultimately make a recommendation for approval or denial of the proposed ordinance to the county council. And so that's, you know, a process moving forward, and regardless of the decision, it will certainly have a big impact on particularly Maui's lifestyle and, you know, economic outlook moving forward.
Yeah, very tough decision. But, you know, just this week, I was reading a story about how Barcelona moved to phase out all of their vacation rentals to tourists within a five-year period, that they are having the same issues with housing for local families as well. So not just a Maui issue.
For sure. There are communities around the world that are sort of re-examining how tourism plays into their communities and how they want the future to look for them. And as Matt Chachowski, who is a housing data, he's been looking at housing data since the fire, Native Hawaiian Maui resident, he pointed out that 53% of families were rent burdened in 2023, and that means they spent 30% of their income or more on housing every month. And 28% of Maui families were severely rent burdened, which means they spent more than half of their income every month on rent. And so, you know, it's a really big issue no matter how you look at it. It's moving forward.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine. We've been talking to HPR's Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Plants like taro, breadfruit, and sweet potato were brought to the Hawaiian Islands by ancient Polynesian voyagers. These plants shaped the food and culture of Hawaii today. But what if there were some uninvited guests hitchhiking a ride with these plants throughout the Pacific Islands? Jut Nguyen, a research professor at Northern Arizona University, has a hunch that certain species of insects found in Hawaii and Rapa Nui might actually be canoe bugs. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender from a Dutch sailing ship near Pitcairn Island, where he is conducting research as part of the Darwin 200 voyage.
The Darwin 200 project, I was brought on as a researcher, and I believe that I'm the first actual researcher to be brought on board. The way that it has worked is they are coordinating young conservationists at the various ports, and the point being is to give them an opportunity to conduct research projects within the theme of conservation and to not only be able to conduct that project, but also learn from the people and learn about the culture, learn about the people as they get to experience the Darwin 200 project. And it is organized by Stuart McPherson out of the UK. This idea was to loosely retrace the voyage of the HMS Beagle, which is the famed ship that Darwin took and made all his discoveries that led to the theory of natural selection. They shot across following the currents and the prevailing winds from the Galapagos on into Polynesia.
I saw that you published on this basically canoe bug hypothesis. Where did your interest in that begin?
Oh my goodness, it was really happenstance. In 2008, I had a NASA-funded project to study cave thermal behavior in northern Chile in the Atacama Desert. And looking at a map, I was like, well, I have to bounce out of Santiago to get to Antofagasta, which is where we drive to get into the Atacama Desert. But you also have to bounce out of Santiago to get to Rapa Nui. And recollecting that the, you know, 1970s National Geographic my grandmother used to get for me at garage sales, I recall seeing those pictures of the moai. And I was like, yes, I want to do that one day. And, you know, when I noticed that I was within striking distance, I did it in 2008. And as a result of that initial trip, I've now been to Rapa Nui 6 times. So I am largely trained as a wildlife ecologist. And I started getting into bugs because of my interest in caves. It just was a natural progression. And so I knew when I went to Rapa Nui that that was going to be what we would need to focus our efforts on. And at first, I was hoping that we were going to, you know, be the team that found the first subterranean adapted arthropods from Rapa Nui. We have not had that kind of luck yet. But what we did discover was we discovered 10 new species that were new to science, undescribed. And of those, most of these animals were restricted to the cave entrances, and they were occurring within the fern garden, the endemic ferns that were within the entrances of the caves. And we've since found them in a few other locations. As the work evolved over time, well, we found a curious pattern. We found a terrestrial isopod that occurred both on Rapa Iti in French Polynesia and on Rapa Nui. And we found, and then we later found out that Hymenocea lapuai, which we initially thought was restricted just to Rapa Nui, turned up on Motu Matira Kiva, which is also known as Sale Gomez. And the connection with the Hawaiian Islands, a Kalimbala, a springtail, that was initially known only to Hawaii. And then we turned, and it turns out that it also occurs within the fern gardens of Rapa Nui Caves. Art Whistler, who is a famed botanist from the Hawaiian Islands, he wrote a book entitled Plants and the Canoe People. And we know that the ancient Polynesians, when they were traveling in their double-hulled voyage in canoes, much like when we car camp, we take everything with us that's going to be in our creature comforts, the things that are going to make us most comfortable while we're camping, and all we have to do is walk 10 feet to our car to fetch something out of it. The ancient Polynesians were no different. They would take with them their creature comforts. And in this case, it was plants. It was plants that could be used for medicinal purposes, for making nets and rope, and, of course, for food. And they would put these plants, these saplings, in gourds. And they would be, you know, within those gourds would be soil. And so because there was soil with those saplings, the idea being is that, well, my goodness, there wasn't a Department of Agriculture to screen those incoming plants. So whatever was in the soil was introduced to those islands. So this was completely accidental. And in terms of whether or not there are alternative explanations, there certainly are. One is that they could have rafted on vegetation. So there's a storm, a tree near the coast falls into the ocean, and the tree trunk floats until it makes land. And all the while, you know, there are these little bugs that are clinging onto it, and they get introduced. Another explanation is that they could be part of the aerial plankton. A third explanation is foraging, where they hitchhike on pelagic birds. We know that an example of pseudoscorpions are known to hitchhike on flying insects and have been anecdotally suggested to also move around by clinging onto the feathers of birds. The final explanation is that they're contemporaneously introduced to these islands. So to address two of those possibilities, we have been having 4 to 6 hour watches every day, where we have the citizen science campaign being undertaken on the ship, where myself and some of the passengers are scanning the ocean, and we're looking for floating debris. And we're specifically looking for vegetation, but we're also documenting unwanted garbage, and that is being documented and will be uploaded to the Marine Debris Survey. So we're making a contribution in that regard as well. The second way in which we are trying to ferret out alternative explanations is we have 4 large clipboards with sticky traps taped to them. And they're up there on the Sunamore itself. And I just climbed up there today to inspect them. And we went up there today to inspect them, and so far, nada. It's not surprising because we were in a very remote part of the Pacific. My hypothesis is that it will, as we get closer to Pitcairn, Right now, we are 285-ish miles from Pitcairn as the albatross flies. And I would expect that we will start picking up. We're more likely as we get closer to land. But once we get to Pitcairn, we're going to pull the trap down, switch out the sticky surfaces, and then redeploy the traps between Pitcairn and Mangareva. Wash, rinse, repeat. We're going to do it all over again. In terms of the sticky traps, we know that Corymbola and we know that terrestrial isopods, those are the two types of canoe bugs or potential canoe bugs, I must say, because we're not certain that that's how they were dispersed. We're calling them potential canoe bugs. They're not going to be dispersed by a wind currents. Mm-hmm. That's simply not possible. Forestry is not possible. The most likely explanation are rafting, vegetation, ancient polyps, or contemporary.
And then how would you tease out between like ancient versus contemporary? Is that you would want to do maybe like genetic sequencing or some type of phylogeny?
Oh, great question. So what we're doing is I'm working with a colleague at the University of Alabama. And if we were so fortunate in that we collect these different potential canoe bugs, in addition to the ones that we collected on this at Rapa Nui, let's say we collect them at Pitcairn, or we're super duper fortunate and also collect them at Pitcairn and Mangareva, we're going to delve into the genetics of these animals. And we're going to use molecular clock analyses to basically a timestamp with date ranges for when animals were likely to have colonized these different islands. And if we're super fortunate, at some point in this process of collecting data, analyzing data, and collecting more data, we might ultimately get to a point where we could overlay the dispersals of some of these invertebrates over what we know about human dispersal throughout the South Pacific or in specific regions of the South Pacific.
That was Jut Nguyen, a Cape scientist with Northern Arizona University, talking to HFR's Maddie Bender. We asked Nguyen what he's been doing to keep seasickness under control. He told us he's been consuming lots of ginger, a cure he learned about from the 1934 Bishop Museum expedition to Mangareva in French Polynesia. The Darwin 200 voyage is expected to make it to that island today before continuing on across the Pacific. Well, that is it for us for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we mark Skyline's first year in operation. We get a status update from City Transportation Services about ridership numbers and from HART on the construction schedule. What do you think about rail service? Call our talkback line. Leave your comments 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google, as well as on our website. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, Maddie Bender, with help from Savannah Harriman-Pope. Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.